Communicating scientific concepts to people is really hard, and it requires effort on the parts of both the creator and the consumer. Videos are a unique medium for investigating science and technology, and my guest today is someone who does this really well and whose work I admire a lot. Joss Fong was a founding member of the Vox video team, and her video production has primarily focused on science and technology. She developed the explainer video format during her time at Vox, and she's now taking her skills to start a new initiative, also focused on science and technology communication. I found Joss incredibly thoughtful about making videos and communicating science, and the intersection of those two endeavors, as well as how AI will impact her craft and the work of video makers like her. I hope you'll enjoy this conversation and that you'll follow her work if you don't already. This is the Gradient Podcast. I'm Daniel Bashir. Here's where I tell you to do all the things about subscribing and following us in all the various places that you're able to follow us. Instead of filling this time with sponsorship ads, I'll just ask you again and again to leave me a rating, to share this with your friends, and anything else you'd like to do. It helps me a lot. Thanks. And now, without further ado, Joss Fong. Before I start asking you questions, Joss, I also want to say this is like probably the most pleasant experience I've had preparing for an interview, because I guess my normal process for this is like I go into my hole and read a bunch of papers, but for this I was like, oh, I get to like go back and rewatch a bunch of Joss Fong videos, which was great. So you've been doing this for a while, and my understanding of the construction of how you got to doing video stuff was like a combination of redirections, it sounded like. The various parts of your story I've heard you tell is you were once doing writing, and you were maybe initially writing about politics, but then you kind of shifted from that into writing about science, and you also realized that you didn't love writing. So you kind of pivoted to doing video. Maybe you could fill in a little bit of that story there. I'm kind of curious how those like redirections landed you in, well, I know you were initially also doing stuff at Scientific American and then after that at Vox. So I'd love to hear you fill in a couple of the details on that story.
Sure. So my career began as a blogger for a nonprofit in DC. This was at the very beginning of the Obama era, and it's a nonprofit called Media Matters. And what they do is they kind of keep an eye on conservative and right-wing media sources. I started out my job on talk radio. So I would literally like go into work, put on my headphones and listen to Rush Limbaugh. His show was hours long. And we were basically just trying to pull out clips to make sure the general public knew the kind of things that he was saying. And then after time, I graduated to Fox News, watching a lot of Fox. There was a period where I would wake up at 4 a.m., get to the office and watch Fox and Friends, which is a 3-hour kind of mind-numbing experience. And we would just write pieces, you know, they got this wrong or this is what they're saying. And, you know, after a while, I got pretty tired of being part of a just that environment. I mean, I don't know if you remember what it was like when the first couple of years of Obama's presidency, but people were losing their minds, like just the most ridiculous debates and faux controversies, very little focus on policy in television news. And it's just, it wears on you after a time. Fortunately, I was able to kind of focus on climate. After I was at Media Matters for a couple of years, there was some initiative around, you know, paying attention to how climate change was being portrayed in the news, climate change and also other environmental issues. And that gave me a chance to kind of start talking to scientists more in my job. So Fox News would say something that was, you know, reliably misleading or false. I would call up some scientists and say, you know, what is the real truth around this? And I just really enjoyed that process. And after, I think, 4 years in that job, I decided to go to grad school for science journalism to try to make that jump from kind of the blogging world into a proper journalism role. And there's a lot of debates about whether J school is worth it. I don't know if I would necessarily recommend it to everybody, but in this case, there's just no way my career works without that program. So it's NYU's Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program. They have amazing professors. You know, you really get trained in how to engage with research, evaluate evidence, talk to reporters, talk to researchers. And so I went there, and they have a really strong internships program. So they place you in internships in New York City. I, at some point in that program, in that 1.5 years, came to the realization that the demand for writing probably wasn't increasing. You know, there were a couple really great science writing jobs, a couple people who get months and months, sometimes years, to work on amazing magazine pieces, but the number of those people was so obviously tiny. Most of the science writers had to spend years proving themselves by, you know, writing up single studies. In some cases, a lot of graduates of this program end up in the comms offices, a research institution, stuff like that. So I switched to video while I was in grad school. I don't know exactly, like in retrospect, I think I had a sense that there would be more demand for video in the digital news industry at that time. Basically, the only players were Vice and BuzzFeed in terms of like digital video. So there was a lot of work to be done there. And it's also just a lot more fun, in my opinion. There's still a lot of painful writing that goes into scripting a video, but you have all of these other tools to play with. And I'm a bit of a dabbler. So it was attractive medium to me. And I was able to kind of gear my internships at NYU toward video internships, like a couple in documentary and this one at Scientific American, which was a digital video internship, which was really pivotal for me getting my hands on the tools.
Yeah.
SIAM doesn't have like a big video operation. They had one guy, his name was Eric Olson, and he was making their videos pretty much by himself. So when I came in as his intern, you know, he had a lot for me to work on, and that, you know, it was After Effects work, it was Premiere work, it was running the camera sometimes. And those were all things that I absolutely needed to learn. And so that was really a great experience.
Yeah, you're on quite a few videos from Scientific American. And I remember noticing that you were the editor, but maybe not the host on most of them. So I kind of dug around until I found one where you were the host. And it was interesting, I guess. There's like watching that video and then watching your videos now, I think there's a lot of shifts, I guess, in your style and also your presence as a host and kind of the role you inhabit, I guess, as like a narrator in the story. And that's kind of a through line I want to trace. But another thing that came up for me in the story you just laid out too was how much what you were choosing to do, it seemed like, at least to a little bit of an extent, it's tied up a bit with consumption as well. Like, you have to consume a lot of material and to talk to a lot of people in order to do what you do. And the getting up at 4 a.m. to watch 3 hours of Fox and Friends things seems like maybe not the most pleasant mode of consumption generally. And I guess I'm wondering really broadly, like, how you think about your own consumption, I suppose, in like the context of how you do your work.
Yeah, I haven't thought about it in a while, but I think that job kind of trained me to be able to sit with a lot of presentations that were uncomfortable, and to engage with arguments that, unless I was being paid to, I probably wouldn't have. And I think it also made me very detail-oriented and sort of a stickler about facts and fact-checking and things like that, that all kind of filter into how I do my work now, probably. But I just try to read the whole internet every day. Like, it's really bad. I've got so many streams of content coming at me constantly. I go to the gym and that's where I watch YouTube. You know, it's like TikTok is for a different place, and my newsletters, and I have print magazines. It's really excessive. But I have this experience of realizing that the more information that you're able to take in on a topic, the more accurate and nuanced and unique the thing you're able to make becomes. It's like there's not really maybe there is a point at which it doesn't improve the piece, but in my experience, given the timelines that I have, the more I learn about it, the better I'm going to be able to do at my job, which is not great for work-life balance, but it's just true. You know, if you're doing explainer journalism, your task is to understand the big picture so that you can convey it accurately and fairly to people. And that just takes a lot of reading.
How do you find clarity among that? Because I do see how when you consume more and more information, you get really broad strokes on the topic, but especially on controversial things, for instance, and you've done videos on pretty controversial topics, the information can just get, people are coming from different places. Do you often find that you're able to get to a point where you think, okay, here's what the facts appear to be, here's what the reasonable takes on them are, and you find yourself kind of more and more able to, I suppose, like sift through the information, what seems reasonable, what seems less reasonable, or does it ever just get kind of overwhelming for you at a point? I'm curious how you like find clarity amidst all of that.
Yeah, no, it's overwhelming every time. Every time. There's no point at which like this document of notes that I have is not complete chaos. But it's not so much about what's reasonable and what's not. It's about how difficult the materials are for my own personal brain, you know, and the education that I have and the experience that I have leaves me limited when I engage with a lot of technical fields. And so it's often a feeling of smashing my brain against something that is a little bit beyond my comprehension until eventually I get it. And that's not a fun process, but, you know, I very often have the experience of, you know, starting out a story by looking for the published research on that topic, reading a study and kind of not quite understanding it. This is particularly like in computer science where the papers are completely inscrutable.
Relatable. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely fields where it's like the papers are in English and these are words that I understand. But for the kind of more statistics and math based stuff, it's like, I feel lost and stupid with a first read. I keep researching for weeks and then I go back and read that paper and it's been unlocked in some ways, like never completely, but enough for me to feel like, one, I can do a good job explaining to my audience what they need to know about this. And two, I can actually probably do this at a deeper level than most of the treatments in the news media that I've seen on it. Those are sort of the kind of two things I'm aiming for. So yeah, that's kind of my process.
The papers in ML especially, I think their ways, it's gotten better and worse, but I often find them still more abstruse than they have to be. And I think this is also just an artifact of publishing conventions and everybody trying to game a system that has set up certain incentives. But there's a lot of math there that is there for no reason, and it doesn't help anybody understand it, including people who have to actually read these papers for their real work. And, you know, that includes journalists, that includes other researchers. And I don't think anybody likes it. I think we're getting a little bit better at this. And I think that, honestly, a lot of that is due to, I think, people like you who are making that effort to actually explain this stuff to a wider audience. But if it weren't for that, if it weren't for people like you, or I think Jeremy Howard is another great example of this, then I do feel like there's this kind of old boys club-ishness to it all, where you have what feels a little bit like gatekeeping. But I do think we're getting a little bit better at this. I think a lot of us are trying, I hope. I don't know if that's been like apparent, I guess, for people like you kind of doing your work.
I mean, I've always just thought of myself as kind of eavesdropping on a conversation that is not made for me, and that's totally fine. It's actually quite fun experience to see people who are in a very technical field just kind of exchange information with each other and see what I can glean from it. What I really appreciate are the people who are willing to talk to me about it. You know, like if they need to publish all their math, like by all means, do that. And speak in jargon with each other when you need to. But if you have time to spend, you know, an hour breaking it down and helping me understand the logic of it, that's been really, really great. And there's actually an artist named Kyle McDonald who's been like a bit of an AI whisperer for me over the years, from very early days when I was doing a silly explainer about how Snapchat's filters worked. Like this was when filters were invented. And, you know, I just DM'd him out of the blue because he had worked, he was kind of a pioneer in face swapping. And he was like, sure, I'll talk to you. He wasn't in the piece. Like he's not credited. He didn't get anything from that, but he was so helpful. And then along the way, whenever I cover AI, I kind of just DM him and I'm like, what, you know, who should I be talking to? Who can you connect me with this? And it's been so helpful. And I really, really appreciate people like that.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that I always find the experts you tend to interview, and when you include clips from them, it's often, I mean, I can kind of see that they're very engaged and interested in that process of things. I think you did a really great interview with Dev Raji, for example. I was very excited to see Ted Underwood in one of your videos as well, since he's somebody I interviewed a while back as well. And I think his work is just like really, really interesting. I do want to maybe talk a little bit about craft things and then kind of come back to more AI specific stuff. But it was really important to my understanding of how you understand yourself to hear one thing you said in another video about how you think about yourself as a video person first and a science communicator second. And it's like really, really clear to me that you do science communication well, but I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more to how those two things kind of come together for you?
Yeah. There's a lot of debate about whether people should be using the term science journalist or science communicator. I think the main distinction people make there is whether you're willing to scrutinize and criticize the enterprise of science and the flaws of it. A lot of people who identify as science communicators are employed by the research institutions and stuff like that. So I would say, you know, to the extent that I engage in communicating about science, like I would like to think of myself as a science journalist. But as you said, it's always felt better to call myself a video journalist first. And that's because over the past 10 years, over the past 10 years, my main focus has been trying to figure out all of the different ways you can explain things in video. So, you know, the model has always been kind of the cable news, the broadcast news approach. And then once we came to the internet, you know, there was a need for a lot of experimentation. Obviously, now there's just an abundance, a diversity of approaches. But in 2014, you know, as I said, there was BuzzFeed, you know, kind of featuring their staff in sort of fun little experiments. And there was Vice, who was more or less mirroring the field reporting model from broadcast television with like cooler, hipper, edgier reporters. And so we thought, okay, we don't really want to put a talking head on screen. We want to kind of play with all of the tools that the medium of video provides. And so a lot of that is motion graphics. It took me a long time to learn, and I learned on the job how to animate. So that wasn't like my strong suit, but we brought people on the team like Dion Lee and Estelle Caswell, who really set out our sort of 2D animation style that we're known for. But there's so many other things you could do. You can make videos out of archive. You can film an entire video from a drone. You know, you can build data visualizations in the studio. You can, more recently, I tried to figure out how to innovate on the debate format. So I got a real kick out of stretching the medium as much as possible and focusing my kind of creative powers toward figuring out different formats for video. And it's only now, you know, like a decade later, where I'm starting to shift out of that chapter and into a more consistent science journalism approach, which is what I'll be doing with my new project. Now that I've played around so much and really indulged myself on the creative side, I think more than anything, I just want to be useful to people.
I really appreciate that. Yeah, I do want to come around and talk about your new thing later as well. I do want to ask a bit about that creative development though, and what that looked like for you. So you were one of the founders of Vox's video team, and there's very much a tie-in with Vox really broadly had this mission of explainer journalism. And so the explainer video format is something you're kind of developing along with it. And it's really interesting to trace that development from 2014 to now and just what it looks like for something to be a YouTube video and how that's changed over time. Because the way I see things right now, especially when people are producing advice, explainer videos, there's now this really kind of high bar for even when you're starting a very small channel, what people think that they have to be able to produce in order for people to want to listen to them or to watch their videos. And at the same time, though, I feel like there's this almost like something working against that at the same time, because everything has started to look too perfect. All the cameras are too good. And so if you have something that's not quite perfect, it like distinguishes your work in a pretty different way. But I'm curious how you think about and how you've experienced that development.
Yeah, I mean, I wish that all of the early videos could just be stricken from the internet. We made a lot of bad videos before they got good. And there's really no way around that, I don't think. Maybe there's some kids that are just coming out today with like insane skills, but we had to do a lot of experimentation. And when Vox launched, I don't think anyone really expected video to become a big part of its brand, actually. I was hired as I think my title was multimedia producer. And for the first year, maybe, most of what I did was design infographics that would go inside the articles on our website. And over time, we started making more videos. And as they gained an audience, we were given the freedom to kind of focus there. And I, you know, all credit to Ezra Klein, who was the editor-in-chief at the time, you know, allowed us to, you know, make ugly, awkward video for a while and find our way and find our unique voice on YouTube and build out our team. And that was absolutely the key to Vox's success in video. It's a tough thing to say, you know, just let people go and experiment with your brand on YouTube. But what most news organizations were doing at the time was they didn't want to focus on YouTube because it's honestly like a pretty bad business. but they would want people to come to their website and watch videos where they could control the advertising there. And people don't do that. People go to YouTube to watch video. And, you know, Vox and Jim Benkoff allowed us to focus on YouTube, which was unique. They also allowed us to write our own videos as video journalists, which was and still is pretty unusual. What you'll see is videos have to kind of be filtered through the lens and the you know, labor of writers. For lots of reasons, I understand why they do that, but it ends up becoming, you know, a burden on the writers who it's not their job to write videos or be in videos. And video writing is a skill in and of itself. It's something that we tried to prove for all these years that it's a unique thing. And explaining things in video is a unique thing. And so we were given the opportunity to start pitching and writing our own stories as video producers, which is not something that I ever expected when I took that job. I was just so excited to be working for that operation that, you know, my expectations were really low for what, you know, what role it would play in my own career or my ability to put my voice or my ideas on the internet. But over time, we were able to do that, and people really responded, and the audiences for video became, you know, vast. And so the question was the question about production value?
I think it was about how, well, production value is one of the things I'd noticed, but I think I was broadly just curious about, along with production value, how you'd sort of experienced personally the changes and like what it has been to be a YouTube video over time. And I guess production quality is like an important part of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that when people were, I think a lot of people were kind of watching what we were doing and trying to figure out what was working there. And on the surface level, it looks like slick animations and, you know, maybe some nice music choices and stuff like that. That has been, you know, liberally replicated across YouTube now. And I think what I have saying was like, that's not really our secret sauce. Our secret sauce is a way of writing that puts a lot of work into the visuals, a lot of the work of carrying the explanation and helping viewers comprehend the material. We very early on decided that our animations weren't going to be decorative. And there are beautiful videos and beautiful explainer videos that are relying mostly on decorative animation. But we just decided early on, our visuals need to be doing explanatory work. And then the script is basically walking people through those visualizations. That's, I think, the key to keeping people engaged and to having a chance at them remembering what's in the video. I still am kind of despondent whenever I think about what actually gets retained. And I would love for there to be some research or for me eventually to be able to run some studies to see what of all of this actually sticks in someone's brain. But we really thought very carefully about how to engage the audio and visual sort of channels to maximize comprehension for our viewers and to minimize distraction as much as we could. And it's a really tough balance, but it's kind of a writing puzzle that we really focused on when we train up our team.
It feels really hard to know what hits there. Yeah. And I guess in your case, when I was initially thinking about like questions to ask you and all that, I noticed myself making this kind of style content distinction, and that I had some questions that were more about style, others about content. But it's very clear, especially as you describe the video making process, you've talked about how the writing itself too, it's always starting with the visuals kind of in mind as well. And so there's this inextricable link there. And I think this was in your AI bias video, and you sort of talked about this as well. You had this Rube Goldberg machine, and it was really interesting to me how tactile it was. Like, you had people's hands that were moving things around, which I thought was really cool. And you, I think, said somewhere else that this was really your personal mental model for how this stuff works, and that you weren't entirely sure if this hit in the same way for other people. And I guess it's like hard for me to have an unbiased take on this because I also kind of went in with some background knowledge, but I'm curious how you think about like closing that gap as much as you can. I imagine having other people around who you can maybe just say, hey, like, you don't have a background in this. How does this strike you as maybe beta testers, for example, can help. But I'm kind of curious how you think about that.
Yeah, I think about that a lot. And it's troubling. The second you learn something, you become less effective at explaining it, which is, you know, impossible in many ways to solve. But it does help that I'm a generalist. I genuinely go into every story not knowing what it's about or how it works. And that means I have a lot of empathy for our viewers and can retrace my steps of understanding and try to replicate that experience for them. The thing that I want to do is make an attempt to explain the hard things and hope that the viewers who are really motivated to understand it will kind of do their part too, you know, and meet me there. If you're not really motivated to understand like how machine learning works, for example, I don't think there's any presentation I can do that will force you to learn that. So I want to be there for the people who are motivated. For those who aren't, you know, maybe they still get a sense of it, but not the details. And then ultimately, you know, probably can't make something for everybody. So there are times where I'll make something like that Rube Goldberg explanation of bias and machine learning and, you know, show it to a family member. And they'll sort of be like, yeah, I think I need to watch it again, you know, and it's so disappointing, but it's just the truth that I had to read these things multiple times to understand them. The idea that there's some magical presentation that can make that clear in one watch is maybe a little bit unrealistic, but I want to keep trying to do my best and not doing what a lot of people probably end up doing, which is just assume the audience doesn't care about those details or isn't willing to sit through that kind of explanation. In the case of that piece, it was part of a YouTube Originals program called Glad You Asked, and they funded that show. So we had budgets to play with these kinds of toys, and our showrunner for the first season sort of banned motion graphics for us because it was so clearly a thing that Vox Video relied on. She wanted this show to be different. And so every visualization was going to be tactile and analog, which honestly makes sense sometimes for the information. Sometimes it doesn't, but it was a wonderful exercise, you know, and playful and fun to do. So I'm glad I was able to try that out on a big scale in the studio.
There's two things that really stick out to me in this. One of them is your comment, a really important comment, I think, about being able to expect the person consuming your stuff to do a little bit of work on their end. Because I feel like, theoretically, you can bring things to a level where somebody has to invest less in order to get something. But I feel like the amount of clarity or understanding somebody can get out of a video, especially when done well, and this is maybe of any type of content, seems to scale with the amount of investment they're putting in. And I think that you can really lower that barrier for them in lots of important ways by kind of doing this pre-processing of, I'm going to go read all these papers and digest it and do a little bit of like pre-digestion for you. That sounded really gross, but anyway, you can filter the information for them in certain ways. But I think in order to really give them clear access without, I don't like the term dumbing things down, but really like dumbing things down to an extent where you've taken out a lot of important technical detail and things that are really important to a nuanced understanding, to, I guess, expect somebody to meet in the middle, it feels like you can really deliver a lot more for them in that setting.
Yeah, I think the key is, you know, I want to make it so it doesn't feel like homework or like a chore. That said, it's still going to be, you know, it's still going to require some effort. And at the very minimum, you know, your focused attention, which is a lot to ask of people these days. YouTube is such a double-edged sword because it's this incredible platform that will put your content in the hands of people who are likely to be interested in it. At the same time, while your video is playing, there are at least six other very juicy, algorithmically selected headlines, sports highlights, celebrities eating hot wings, you know, all of that, which is just not something that, you know, a podcaster doesn't have to deal with, you know, every 2 minutes, someone being like, would you rather listen to a different podcast episode that's like exactly what you tend to click on? And it's like right here. That's what it's like to be on YouTube. That and the whole commenting sort of world makes it a very unique, challenging, competitive, vibrant, dynamic place to publish. I wouldn't really have it any other way. There's not like a better alternative, but it is saying like, hey, you need to block out every other possible thing right now and pay attention to this thing because I think it's important and I'm doing my best to make it interesting. I've come up with this elaborate metaphor for you. We spent tons of, you know, time and money making this visualization. So just please pay attention. But I have empathy for people who have a million other things to do. They don't always need to know everything that I have to say. And so, yeah, it's the attention. The attention, as long as it's there, I'm going to do my best to make this stuff approachable and accessible for people. But I think the attention is the hardest part, the hardest thing to hold on to.
I think as consumers, all of us are suffering from that in different ways. But I guess the hope is always that the people who really would engage with your content and would get a lot out of it, find it in the first place and stick with it enough. It feels like you've employed a lot of different tools, like when somebody's watching your videos towards that end too. For Glad You Asked, I think this is something that you all did really, really well and is one of the reasons I really liked that series. There's this thing that I often hear about explainer journalism or certain types of journalism that when people are describing it, one thing they really like is this quality of, this feels like I'm sitting in a room with my really smart friend, watching them or listening to them explain something to me. And it feels like one of the things you did in Glad You Asked is take that and like make it really literal, because you or another one of the hosts, for example, will see you like going and gathering information, and then you'll just like go into a room with one of the other hosts and like sit down and literally just sit there and explain it to them. I'm curious if that's what you kind of had in mind when you were doing things like that.
Mm-hmm. The idea around that show was that you would be able to tag along as we learn something. And to be honest, I don't think that we were totally successful in that. And a lot of people have tried that show. You know, BuzzFeed had an Netflix show called Follow It, which was basically, you know, you tag along with a journalist. And the whole point is to kind of create some interest and transparency around the process of research and reporting. In practice, when you have production schedules and budgets and crew to book, it's not realistic to actually show the real process of learning, which doesn't proceed in any real logical narrative sequence. So what we ended up doing was sort of creating a bit of artificial interactions between the hosts. There were a couple of times where there was actually like genuine, interesting exchange. There was a part in one of Cleo Abrams' episodes about having children where her and I were just like genuinely so interested in the topic that we just talked like real people with stakes, but also some experience researching this, that you can get a hint at the promise of what a show like that could be. In practice, it ended up being like very much more scripted than we expected. In order to make an explanation clear and comprehensive, it has to hit all of these beats. You know, you can't, I don't know. There was lots of constraints on that, but it was a great creative exercise to think about how to not only present all your information in this tactile way, but also do it in conversation with another journalist and kind of bundle that up in a nice little package for people. So it was a good exercise, but in the end, I don't know if it totally worked.
You've also talked a little bit about, it seems like there's ways in which the medium and maybe the demands of an audience have forced certain elements of bringing narrative into your work. You mentioned the way that gathering information can be kind of unstructured, but you've also talked about how you don't totally embrace the word storyteller. And there have definitely been a lot of videos of yours where there is that kind of through line, but I know that it's also this balance you have to strike between you want people to remember certain really important pieces of information and anecdotes can be helpful towards that, but you maybe don't want somebody to just take away like the single anecdote that was maybe really emotionally provocative, but doesn't quite provide enough for somebody to like construct an argument around or something like that. And I guess I'm wondering, like, do you feel like you've made strides in balancing that?
No, it is an ongoing struggle because I think that stories are like sugar for us. You know, we will never not love them. And I think that maybe the news industry hasn't fully grappled with what that means for their mission, particularly in the podcasting world where there's almost like a fetishism for narrative and that a good story becomes almost a moral good, which it's not. That said, like, I love that stuff. I listen to that stuff too. And I am captivated by a magazine piece that's, you know, a narrative written kind of narrative reporting. I totally get why we celebrate it. And that's because it makes us feel things. It keeps us engaged. It gets back to kind of what we're asking our audience to do. And sometimes I want the audience to want more than a great story. And maybe that's fair and maybe that's not. But I think that one of the biggest biases in media is not left or right, but it's kind of this bias toward coherence and narrative and this how satisfying the story is. And I, as someone who has spent a lot of time, you know, reading science papers, the world is just way more chaotic than that. The truth is always chaotic. It's contradictory. You have to hold all these different things in your head at the same time. And I wish we could sort of, as a society, increase our tolerance for that, increase our tolerance for uncertainty and contradiction and confusion. And I think that explainer journalism is a really good way to try to do that. But you still, I still get pulled into these conventions of how do I keep this interesting? If no one is going to be watching the thing, it's all the work of understanding and explaining clearly is completely wasted. So it's something I go back and forth on. I'm definitely uncomfortable with sort of extracting anecdotes from people, particularly about difficult or traumatizing or controversial things. But it's a big part of what journalism looks like today. And I think my feelings on it are pretty unresolved. But being an explainer does insulate me from some amount of that, I'd say.
Yeah, there are places where this has definitely crossed over a little bit. One video that really stuck with me was, I think this was in Glad You Asked, called Is Beauty Culture Hurting Us? And it was really interesting for me to think about your locatedness in that video, because there's something about what it is to be a narrator in a video. And a lot of the videos of yours I've watched, you're kind of there as a guide for us, like through this information, you're telling us what's going on, you're showing us parts of gathering information. And in this story, both you and Cleo and a number of other women as well presented a little bit about how this affected you personally. And so there's this interesting shift kind of in the role you're inhabiting there with respect to what the story is about. And so there's still a lot of explainer stuff going out there, but you're also like a part of the story in an important way. And I'm curious how that felt to you.
I mean, excruciating. Being on camera always for an introvert is miserable. I don't know why I keep doing it. I mean, I do know why. I think that as we go forward, people need and want to know who is behind the content that they're seeing. So I'm going to keep doing it, but it's not, it doesn't come easily to me at all to be myself on camera. And doing that felt like a challenge that was important for me to give myself. The issues that we were covering in that episode are things that I feel very deeply. And so it was an easy one for me to speak genuinely about my experience and interaction with beauty culture. And I also think it was important for us to be part of that story rather than above it or not part of it. And so that's why we did that one. There's a lot of I think I struggle a lot with who my audience is sometimes. And the data that we saw at Vox was that 80% of our audience was male, according to Google. I've always wanted to reach more girls and women. And so sometimes I'll do stories that I think are more likely to get their attention. And the beauty piece was one of those and was successful in that way. And so I think when I am setting out to be reaching out to girls and women who may not typically subscribe to news channels or who haven't seen a lot of Vox videos, I'm more eager and more willing to say like, hey, it's me. I'm one of you. Like I'm a human woman person here. Like, so that was part of that too. I think a lot of what we did in Glad You Asked was not so much about creating the most, you know, technical or comprehensive explainers and more about trying to mix up how we were presenting information and do a lot of experiments in that way. And really making it up as we go along and meeting deadlines that we weren't used to and having stakeholders that we weren't used to. So it was a lot of different compromises.
Yeah, that sounds like a really interesting process. I think that video just like really stuck with me in particular for lots of reasons, but I know I like wasn't the intended audience for it, but it did make me think a lot about I've had personal experiences with, you know, things related to this. And so as a guy, I guess it's not nearly on the scale that women experience this sort of thing, but kind of experiencing the personal stories in that video and also a lot of the data as well, and thinking about experiences I've had and like how deeply that affected me, and then imagining it's a lot worse for a lot of people out there. I think also just like forced a lot of rumination. So, I mean, a lot of like, yeah, a lot of kudos for that video.
I'm glad to hear it. Yeah, that one, we would get into these discussions in the office. Like a lot of people would just sort of migrate from their desk while we were talking about these issues. And we would just, everyone would have something to say or some experience. And I feel very strongly that the internet is harming, is kind of counterproductive for feminism. Not the internet. I would say image-based social media is setting women back in a way that I feel very strongly. And it's also, you know, tied up in all of these different questions about how a journalist what needs to be online in order to be successful, and reflecting on sort of what role image plays in my own career and, you know, how much to pay attention and lean into that or try to counter it. It's, you know, there's a lot of different difficult questions related to beauty and the internet and feminism and girls, and they're all sort of constantly swirling in my head.
I'm going to use this as a really bad segue into AI things, because I think that there is an AI take on this as well. You mentioned Snapchat beauty filters earlier, which is one manifestation of this, but we've also seen a lot of apps out there like Lensa, and I think that with like generative AI art, which you did a really great video on that I think people should go watch if they haven't. There's also this opportunity, or I think opportunity is a really bad word for this, but you can now like take a few selfies or something and generate photos of your face that have like very prominent cheekbones and your face looks very thin and perfect in all sorts of ways that it might not look in real life. And that was something that I really was not a fan of. And I think I recall myself writing something about how I'm probably never going to use Lensa because this just seems like a really bad idea. But I'm curious how, I mean, you've done a number of videos on, you know, topics kind of related to this. So I'm kind of wondering how maybe on the one hand, related to some of this beauty culture stuff you experience and think about the phenomenon of like people using not just filters, but like literal full generations of their face, but then also maybe how some of your engagement with the literature and experts and like researching all of this has made you think about it as well.
Yeah, it's quite grim. I mean, I think that if you go back, you know, centuries, you see this theme that women are for looking at. You know, it's in a million paintings. And that theme has just, I don't know, maybe I'm being idealistic about the 80s and 90s, but it felt like that was fading away a little bit. Obviously, there were beauty magazines, there were supermodels. But the rise of image-based media is effectively enrolling every girl, to some extent every person, but you really see it with girls and women, into a beauty pageant that they didn't sign up for. The algorithms undoubtedly prefer to show people images of women's faces and bodies. Like anytime I post a selfie, which is not often, the algorithm juices that like crazy. The algorithm. It's a mix of consumer behavior, and there's some evidence that like Instagram computer vision knows when there's a female body. I don't know. It's complicated. But then you have that beauty contest that has always been corrosive for the mental health and in some ways the achievement of women. And then you layer onto that every possible tool to augment your appearance. And what you see a lot is editing apps, filters that not just kind of put makeup on you, but they will also change the shape of your face. They narrow noses. Like they, I'm half Chinese. I have like a little bit of a wider nose. It will like shrink it down. It does that to any ethnicity that has a wider nose. It will narrow it will feminize your jaw. It will make your eyes and your lips bigger. These are like things to make you look more like a child, like a white child specifically. And I think that it's incredibly corrosive. And then on top of that, what you have are algorithmically driven conversations targeted towards and among girls and women about ways to improve your appearance, which include everything from the most harmless makeup tutorial to very detailed breakdowns of what it's like to get a nose job or some other operation. And every woman on the internet is torn between condemning those and looking like you're not a girl's girl and blaming, you know, in some way coming across as blaming girls and women for choosing to participate in this competitive hierarchy, which is proven to improve your outcomes in all sorts of ways if you are seen as attractive. And, you know, between kind of going along with it and seeing this normalization of a vast amount of labor and maintenance from, you know, for the whole life cycle, you know, from when you're a child, skincare is big among Gen Alpha, to, you know, there are boomer women talking about their procedures. So it's a mix of the way that those conversations become served as soon as you pay attention. Who doesn't pay attention to a before and after? I don't know anyone who doesn't click on that or watch that when it comes up on the feed. But once you do, you're going to start being fed more of that. It's really hard for me to imagine being a teenage girl at this time. And I think you see it in all of the data about their mental health that this is taking a toll. Now, there are lots of studies that need to be done to establish the causal relationship there. But from the mechanism alone, from my own experience as like a woman in her 30s engaging with this stuff, I can't imagine that it is not taking a toll on young brains. And so AI is a big part of that, but it's basically juicing an aspect of our culture that we never really fixed, which is this idea that we're interested in the, you know, the insides of men and the outsides of women. You see that shifting. Now we're interested in the outsides of everybody. I do think that the younger men are starting to go in this direction as well. And I don't think it's good for anybody. So yeah, that said, AI is like a really giant, it's a bummer that we have this word, one word to describe all of these different predictive systems. And so there's parts of it that I find fascinating and exciting, and there's parts of it that I find concerning and depressing. But I've had the opportunity to kind of cover different aspects of it, which has been great.
Yeah. An important note there is that cultural interplay. I mentioned Ted Underwood, who we both interviewed, and one of the things that he says, or a term he uses to describe the text-to-image generative models, is models of culture. And to what you're saying, the cultural values that we have around men and women and the things we pay attention to in a gendered way, I mean, of course, when you take a model and soak up everything on the internet, it's going to get a little bit of that value. Well, a lot of that value. And so it's definitely like the self-reinforcing cycle. And I guess there's like, for AI people, one thing that's often thought about is, and I think this is true also in the context of text-only systems, how you are compensating for that. And there's this articulation of like, alignment techniques like reinforcement learning for human feedback, making these systems kind of sound nicer, and that this is just like a band-aid over a system that is fundamentally misaligned from what you might want it to do. And I guess there's this kind of lingering question always of how much, like, how or is it even possible to create systems that are aligned in a more core kind of way without changing a lot of what's underlying there, like the data. But then to change the data is an artifact of like where we are as a human society and our culture in lots of ways. So do you actually get there without just changing like what it is to be human in this day and time? And so I think that really adds a lot to, it's kind of a cliche, I guess, to say that the AI systems we're building now are like a mirror onto society in lots of important ways. But I think when you like open that up, it's interesting. And I guess it starts to feel a lot harder to think about we want to develop systems and stuff that make it possible for people to, like men and women, to have healthy perspectives on themselves. And all of this is like so tied up together in lots of complicated ways that I think when you like open the Pandora's box enough, you just start to get like, again, overwhelmed and confused with information and like what you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. I mean, bias is so obvious in these systems. It's almost refreshingly obvious. And in some ways, the bias that you see in generative AI, in image AI, is less concerning to me than some of the more hidden bias that you see in AI systems that may be used by various corporations. One of the things that the Midjourney founder said to me was like, this is a tool that lets you see what you want. So yeah, if you put in a doctor, you're going to see a sort of an older white man, and you do that with that. That's what you get with almost all of the sort of prestigious professions in our society. But if you just say like, I want to see an Asian woman doctor, it will give you that. So I think in some ways, bias in these systems is when the user is able to prompt it, is less concerning to me than what users are doing with it. And this is where I think the training data is one thing. It's definitely a choice to put porn in your training data set, which is what Stable Diffusion is trained on, partially, in large part. You don't have to do that. But then you have this pool of users, of early adopters, who I imagine are largely men, particularly the ones that are using the open source models, who are clearly asking for it to create, you know, what you would call like sexually objectifying material of women, whether it's fantasy women with, you know, the faces of children and giant boobs, or it's deepfakes of people that they've either met or know online, or celebrities. The responsibility for that, while there's lots that, you know, the responsible companies are doing, this stuff is fully out of the bag. And I think that it's worth paying attention to what the users are doing. And, you know, there are reporters who are really on top of that, of looking inside these communities and seeing what they're generating. But yeah, it's really apparent who makes this stuff and who it's for sometimes when you open an app like Lensa and you're a woman and it puts you in a bikini. It's basically telling you like this wasn't made for by any women, which isn't new when it comes to the tech industry, and not just this AI world, but the whole social media world, which was created by very early 20-something dudes in California who couldn't possibly have been thinking about the implications for girls and women and feminism when they put out things like Snapchat, which was explicitly marketed as kind of a way to get sexy images from girls. The founders of YouTube thought of their initial site as like a way of, they were inspired by hotornot.com, and they were like, how can we do this for video? Obviously, Facebook was the initial iteration, was ranking girls by appearance at Harvard. This stuff is like through and through of a, you know, it's a 22-year-old man's brain put into software that then changes the course of history. And that sort of audacity and recklessness continues today through these AI systems. And while I think what these models are doing is like conceptually fascinating and almost mystical in ways of the way that they are kind of ingesting human visual culture and allowing us to operate it, it remains the case that they are putting these things out there with seemingly very little interest in the potential unintended consequences and who those burdens are likely to fall on.
That's totally right. Yeah. And I think that a good amount of this too is kind of downstream from the way in which some of these initial motivations and specific cases kind of get lifted into this. Sometimes it's almost like a messianic way of looking at the people who create these things, but then also this almost religious way of viewing progress, I think. And I feel like there are certain spaces in the AI community that I feel have this very confused notion of what progress actually means. Like one way I've kind of come to think about it, I guess, is that the blunt version of that is we want to make available more advanced technologies for some definition of advanced. And a lot of people view just making that available and like allowing it to exist in the world, whatever the consequences might be, as a notion of progress. But when you, as you're saying, think about unintended consequences, some of those are going to be literally regressive in all sorts of important ways. And when people start writing manifestos around this and start creating potentially cult-like organizations that start with that, that it's hard to, I don't know, it all becomes very confused. And I think that, like, I often, like, I don't know what to think about it. There's often, like, also these kind of included or embedded inevitability narratives about progress is just kind of what happens. But then I think, you know, this is obviously taking into account like a certain definition of progress, and then progress for whom? Like, what does that actually mean? I don't think that gets interrogated enough. And I think that has implications to some of the concrete questions you were just talking about too, when it comes to how are these models getting used. There are a lot of good arguments for open source and also a lot of bad arguments for open sourcing models. But again, there are those downstream implications of if a company starts putting guardrails on their text to image systems for not allowing people to generate porn or something, somebody's going to open source a pretty similar model, and then you can like run it locally on your laptop and do that anyway. And so I guess there's this really interesting kind of mindset thing, and a lot of it is tied up with what you said about a lot of the demographics being like young men in their 20s living in the Bay Area. And that is going to, that sort of person is probably going to have a very particular notion of what progress means and how you achieve that. But I'm curious how you think about that a little bit, just like the idea of, like, big question, but like, you know, progress, what that means for whom, and how that kind of ties into some of this.
Yeah, I think that there was, I would really wish for there to be more exchange and integration between the humanities and the tech worlds. On both sides, there's a lot of misunderstanding. When I listen in on Twitter to some of the conversations that are happening in Silicon Valley, which are often, like, surprisingly often about gender and dating and relationships, it strikes me that there are just like whole college courses that some of these guys have never been exposed to. And it feels like everyone should be doing a study abroad in the other culture, you know, and the polarization between, you know, the press, which is in many ways, you know, grows out of the humanities, and the tech world, which is so dismissive and resentful of journalists, is probably just really harmful for everybody. But it gets amplified in all of these ways when engineers just move forward in a way that seems more rash than ever. And then journalists need to explain, explore, clean up after the messes that are left behind by those, you know, quote unquote innovations. And then that sets up this tension that becomes so icy that it feels hard to break. But I think that the discussion of progress is hiding like another more simple belief, which is just this stuff is inevitable. If it's not us, it's someone else. We'll try to do a better job than that guy. I don't know how true that is. Like, it's hard for me to say. It's hard for me to argue that it's not. But I'm trying to think back into history and remember a time when technology companies released products as sort of a way to experiment on their users. And this has really become clear to me after the release of ChatGPT and other, you know, products that are more or less wrappers for it, is that they don't work the way that they're advertised in many ways. I mean, the people making them didn't necessarily expect them to work, are just as surprised as everyone else that they do what they do, and can't possibly put out any sort of user manual that would give you an understanding of what it's going to do for any given query. This seems like a new world to me, that untested technologies are released on the public, and then we are basically responsible for quality control. In the past, you know, people would make a microwave and they would do their quality control before putting it on the market. And somewhere along the way, that norm seems to have been lost. And I don't know, am I wrong about this? Or is this really weird and new that you can just put something out and say like, hey, this is supposed to do this. And then when you look at it, you're like, it doesn't do that. Actually, it does this other thing. They're like, oh, maybe we'll try to fix that if we can. That seems weird and different to me.
That seems totally right. Yeah. And I feel like OpenAI is kind of pretty explicit about this, and obviously they have pretty different wording for it. But I know that the classic Sam Altman argument is we're going to keep developing GPT N+1, and eventually this might possibly get unsafe. And the safest way for us to do things is to successively roll out these versions to the public so the public can work with it and understand what's actually going on there. And it is true, I guess, that OpenAI has only so much capacity to do that internal testing themselves. But you're right that that is definitely like offloading quality control to the public. And to what you were saying about this tension between tech people and journalism, I suppose I see journalists as very intimately tied up with the kind of progress technologists can make, because I think that it takes a journalist, somebody explaining through an article or a video, for people to think about and understand things exactly like what you're saying about this is fundamentally like offloading quality control to other people. And I think that without understanding that, I feel like people can't really engage with certain products or use certain technologies in as informed a manner as they might otherwise. And it just really strikes me that we've also been like talking about bias in AI, but then you have people very insulated in the tech world who will talk about extreme bias in journalism that maybe appears more in certain types of beats than others. But it's like very interesting to watch that insularity on each, or at least definitely on the technology side, and kind of how that affects the way that technologists perceive journalists and vice versa.
Yeah. I also think there's a lot of hidden disagreement about what journalism is even for. So there's a lot of talk about how there's a negativity bias in the media, and that it sort of assumes a purpose of the media to kind of reflect the world as it is. There's another way to look at it, which is not necessarily how I do, but I do think there's another way to look at journalists as sort of the smoke alarms of our society. And you wouldn't like complain that your smoke alarm has a negativity bias. Like, the point is to catch things before they become really destructive. And I think until we have some sort of agreement, or at least some sort of explicit conversation about what we expect tech journalism to be for, we're going to have this continued kind of misunderstanding and resentment between the two camps. That said, there are absolutely incentives in the media to, you know, get scoops and have a headline that's sensational, and, you know, pointing out like failures and controversies is a easy way to do that. So I think sort of both camps have their own incentives that aren't necessarily serving like the most comprehensive discourse on this that we need to have. And I don't know if there's too much to do about that. I do think that there's been a little bit of self-correction that I've seen. Some of the biggest tech journalists that I follow seem to be really cognizant of the reputation that journalists have had of being overly negative about technology. And so I think we may be swinging the other direction now, but it's a little bit hard to tell.
Yeah. The incentives thing really sticks out to me. And I guess I have like a tiny amount of personal experience with this, because the gradient has been, I guess it's hard to define exactly what it is. Like, I guess I described it to you earlier as, you know, initially just kind of a platform, but we do like put out things that are broadly classified under news. And I wouldn't call us like journalists in the traditional sense, but it's like we have this platform, we have this audience. And so we are curating information that people are seeing. But I guess the nice thing about the gradient is that I feel like we have none of the traditional incentives of an institution, because this is like a hobby project put together by like a bunch of kids in our 20s, basically. And so we're like not making money out of this or anything. Like we, I guess, taken enough so that none of us have to pay out of pocket to support the gradient. But that crafts like a very, very different set of incentives for us. And I think I've noticed that I can like make editorial decisions about our newsletter or about the podcast that would look probably very different if I had any concern at all about growing this thing to a certain number of subscribers. And I guess it's like, it's very important to me that there are like publications and things like this that kind of exist without those growth incentives, because I think that this like inevitably leads in unwanted directions. But at the same time, it's like this exists because there's like a group of us who are willing to put our time into it without getting like money or anything else out of it. And I feel like that doesn't really scale up very well, I suppose. And it's like hard to for a lot of organizations like that to exist.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge conversation right now as newsrooms are doing these major layoffs. It's like, what can be done to preserve these businesses, given that there's just a limited amount of sort of philanthropic funding for newsrooms? If the news always has been and always will be a business to some extent, you know, what is the model that's going to work? And I keep coming back to like bugging the audience to be better, but like, you get more of what you engage with. You know, everyone who complains about coverage should understand that every click, every quote tweet, every argument is registered by these publications as engagement. And if what you want is really like meaty, dispassionate, balanced, and fair explainers, you need to click on that. You need to read the whole thing. You need to share it, talk about it, comment on it. We get the media that we deserve. And so I hope that there's just a general sense of responsibility on the part of the consumers, both just in the general public, but, you know, engineers in the tech industry who engage with tech journalism to incentivize what they want to see more of in terms of, you know, the kinds of investigations that are conducive to progress and democracy.
We get the media that we deserve is a really good way to put a fine point on this. The last thing I kind of want to talk about here is, so I guess looking forward in terms of like the craft of video, I imagine this is something that you're probably thinking about a fair amount, especially I think now that we have like these AI video generators. And you and Aaron Filkey, I hope I'm not like totally butchering the pronunciation of his name there, were winners at, you know, the first AI film festival powered by Runway. And I watched this video, I mean, really well done. And I noticed, I guess, it felt like you didn't kind of overdo it with the graphics in this video. Like there are parts at the end where I can see bits feel clearly AI generated, but there's a fair amount that feels like it could be done with current production tools, though maybe a bit hard. But I'm wondering to hear a little bit about like A, your process of creating this video in particular, but then B, how you think about the impact of some of these tools, things like what Runway is building on your craft.
Mm-hmm. I have been fascinated with image generation since I first came across Midjourney images on Twitter. And this was when there was like 1,000 people allowed to access this beta on Discord. And I remember very distinctly, just like for days, just like sitting and staring and being baffled that this was possible. It's hard to kind of remember what that felt like because we become used to things so quickly. But I think that there's something really incredible about image generators and now video generators in the ability to conjure up some image from like this really vast multidimensional space. And my experience, which we kind of hint at in that piece, is that I feel the real limits of my own creativity when I sit in front of these systems. And I think you see it in, you know, the bulk of what's being created. And this is, you know, again, analogous to the camera, which is like we all have a camera in our pockets. Most of us do very little that's interesting with it. And that just remains to be the case. You know, having a unique idea, creativity is so much more scarce than I think we've ever really confronted, because we've had this conflation of creative work as like partly ideas, but also partly technical execution. And if you could draw really well, maybe they'd call you a creative person. But when you boil it down to a concept or an idea, you really feel the scarcity of that skill. And so I guess what I would say is that nothing abundant is valuable. You know, nothing easy is really treasured. And so what happens when you introduce this system that makes certain things easy is that we look for different things to be hard. And I think that process will continue forever. I've experimented with them a little bit, but it's not obvious to me what the role of generated imagery is in a journalistic product. There are times when I can imagine myself generating elements for an animation, but for people whose job is to cover the real world, I think there is a loss of trust if you rely too heavily on generated imagery. So I'm being cautious about how much we use it. In that piece, like as you said, very little was AI images, which is why we were surprised that we were accepted into that festival and then that we were able to win prize. But I think whatever's easy, there's going to be a ton of, and will become uninteresting quite quickly. So it's one of those things that just is a new challenge for people to find ways to stand out. I think that the kind of motion graphics that Vox used to distinguish our visual approach will become pretty trivial to make, which may be great because honestly, it's laborious and kind of time intensive right now to move keyframes around in After Effects. So I'm kind of eager for innovation in that way, but we're gonna want rare things. We just won't stop wanting rare stuff in our media diets. And so my hope is that what people will want is a really detail-oriented, curious, and motivated journalist to help them understand what's true in the world. And that's what I'm trying to focus on, is being that kind of evidence guru for folks going forward, where the world is really hard to navigate, information is really hard to navigate, you don't know who to trust, you don't know what's real, what's not. That's just going to become more so the case. And I'm hoping that I can provide some sort of groundedness for folks with this new YouTube channel that we're starting.
I'm really excited to see that. I also wanted to briefly comment on the beat you mentioned with regard to like the scarcity of creativity. And I think how we're conflating skill and that fundamental creative drive that feels, I guess, important kind of looking forward. And I know this is something like people have been thinking about for a while. There's this bit, like Leo Tolstoy wrote this tract really late in his life called What is Art? And he advances this really interesting argument that I think it's a really good exercise in like consistently believing something and then taking it to its logical conclusion. And I do think that leads into some kind of weird places, honestly. But one of the things he points out is he doesn't like art schools because they, like, he thinks fundamentally what art is. And I know this is like very slightly different, but I think overlaps a little bit with like explainer journalism and all of this, is that he thinks that the point is to make somebody feel something. And I guess you can look at certain types of explainer journalism as like making somebody understand something. And he thinks that the improvement in skill level really is kind of orthogonal to that in important ways. So just because you're better at shooting a video, for example, doesn't mean that you are more fundamentally capable of making somebody feel or understand something with that tool. And as you're talking about the way our tools are going to improve and allow people to produce things more and more easily, as you're saying, that's going to be a pretty different thing to focus and hone in on, which obviously improves like accessibility in lots of important ways. But yeah, I guess it's like a different set of skills people are going to more clearly be able to delineate and focus on, like that fundamental drive to create something that's either emotive or just having that capacity to explain something really, really well.
Yeah, I welcome anyone who is genuinely motivated to insert clarity and explanation into the internet. I think I increasingly think of the internet as like a battleground between this good and evil, and not evil in like the sense of murder, genocide, evil, but internet evil, which is the spammers, the marketers, the manipulators, the people who are trying to sell you something, the propagandists. They have now a massive tool in their hands, and the rest of us, you know, the people who are moderating Reddit subreddits and the people who are editing Wikipedia and the people who put tutorials onto YouTube for free for anyone to watch and learn, we are up against, and the journalists of the world, like people who want to, out of, you know, whatever motivation they have, insert clarity and creativity and helpfulness onto this, you know, digital commons that we have, we are in a battle against the dark side. And I hope that the platforms find a way to put the thumb on our scale rather than theirs. But I do think that there's a real risk of the noise overwhelming the signal for folks and competing with AI-generated videos, clickbait, AI-generated clickbait on YouTube is something that I'm not looking forward to doing. And I'm hoping that I can take a cue from a lot of the newsletter writers to find a way to escape the algorithmically driven viewership and connect directly with people who say, I want to see you. I can't always count on the algorithm giving me you, but I do want to see when you publish. And so I'd like to see platforms find ways to preserve those relationships as the noise becomes, you know, exponentially large. So, I think that if there are folks who are motivated to do explainers and they don't feel like they have traditional production skills, if they have found tools that help them do that, whether it's creative work or explanatory work or journalistic work, I'm all for it. You know, whatever tools we can get into those curious and motivated minds, I fully support, and I'm excited to see what people do with that if they can't afford a camera, for example. There's no doubt in my mind that we have not become close to tapping the amount of creative potential out there in the public. So I welcome it.
Yeah, I really hope to see more of this too. I feel like I could honestly continue this conversation like indefinitely, but you've already given me a lot of your time. So I think this is a good note to end on. Joss, I've been like a huge fan of your work for years, so it's really cool to get the chance to actually talk with you. I want to thank you for all the work you've already done, and I'm really, really excited to see your new YouTube channel. So thank you for talking with me and for taking the time.
Well, thanks for being interested. And I'm sorry that a part of what we do is like grow and learn in public, which means that the older stuff is not so good. And it's embarrassing. And I'd rather that you didn't watch it. But the fact that you did shows that you really do your homework. And I appreciate that. I'm still learning and getting better at this. And if anyone is interested in what we're working on, I'm working with a journalist named Adam Cole on a channel called Howtown. We're going to be launching later this year. And every episode will be answering a how do they know that question. So if you hear that, you know, economists are saying a recession is coming, we're going to say, how do they know that? Or, you know, commonly repeated facts, the human body is 60% water, we're going to say, how do they know that? And the goal of our channel is really to make evidence more accessible to people and sort of help people navigate what strong evidence looks like. What does limited evidence look like? When is it reasonable to expect certainty from researchers? Pretty much never, by the way. And so that's what we're up to. And I hope people will tune in, but it's not there yet. So
that's it. That's the whole episode. Thank you for listening. If you like this, really the best thing you can do is to leave me a review and to share this episode with someone who might find it interesting. You can also subscribe to the podcast in your favorite podcast player. And if you want to keep up to date with the latest from The Gradient, to receive emails whenever we have new podcasts, newsletters, articles, then you can subscribe to us on Substack, where you'll get email notifications for everything.